WOLA wishes to thank the Samuel Rubin Foundation for the support that made this podcast possible.
Americans and Cubans alike are ready to move forward. I believe it's time for Congress to do the same. And I've called on Congress to take steps to lift the embargo that prevents Americans from traveling or doing business in Cuba.
From the United States, we don't have to change our policy. It's the Castro regime that has to change its policy.
The problem that Cuba has is a regime for half a century that is a totalitarian Marxist regime that violates human rights, that oppresses its people, that murders.
Here's a good deal. Cuba has free elections. Cuba stops putting people in jail for speaking out. Cuba has freedom of the press.
These are some of the arguments we hear from U.S. lawmakers who are leading the charge to keep in place the 56-year-old embargo against Cuba. I'm Adam Isaacson.
And I'm Sarah Kenosian.
And welcome to the third and final episode of our series on Cuba. Episode 1 looked at changes in Cuba's economy, and last week we talked about political debate and civil society on the island.
Today, we're going to unpack U.S. policy towards Cuba. Since 1960, just after Fidel Castro took power, the U.S. government has maintained an economic embargo on the country, preventing American companies from doing business there and U.S. citizens from traveling there. Since 1996, that embargo has been a part of U.S. permanent law, requiring an act of Congress to undo it. Still, over the past year and a half, the Obama administration has chipped away at it. Since announcing in December 2014 that the two countries would restore diplomatic relations, the White House has significantly eased trade and travel restrictions. But the president can only do so much, and the embargo still stands.
In this episode, we'll get into how recent changes in U.S. policy have impacted life on the island. We'll look at why, after decades, the tide is finally starting to shift in Congress, especially among Republicans. We'll also ask how soon it is that we're likely to see an update in U.S. policy towards Cuba.
Following a news conference in Washington, President Eisenhower orders a drastic reduction in the Cuban sugar import quota for this year. After patient waiting and much deliberation, the setback to Cuba's economy is finally triggered by Premier Fidel Castro's seizure of two American and one British oil refinery.
That was in early 1960 and was the first step ever taken to restrict trade with Cuba. It was followed later that year by an embargo on all trade, which was hardened in 1962. The expectation was that, by depriving Cuba's communist government of access to U.S. capital and markets, it would bring about regime change and human rights improvements to Cuba.
It didn't do that. But even though the Cold War ended 25 years ago, the embargo has remained in place. The driving force behind it in Congress has been Republicans and vocal Cuban-American members, including some Democrats, most of whose families were driven out of Cuba when the Castros came to power. They include lawmakers like Mario Díaz-Balart, Republican of Florida, Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, Ileana Ros-Lehtinen, Republican of Florida, Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, and Albio Ciudas, also Democrat of New Jersey. In defense of the embargo, they cite human rights abuses, Cuba's one-party system, and its economic model, and they continue to argue that any money flowing into Cuba, through the tourism industry or otherwise, simply helps keep the Castros in power. They view any U.S. policy change as a concession to a military dictatorship, one that hurts the Cuban people.
On year 56 of this policy, though, Cuban does remain starved for capital, but the second Castro president is still in power, there is still one political party, and human rights abuses continue. Simply put, the embargo has failed.
Now, on the whole, the people on the other side of the debate, those who support changing the policy, don't deny that human rights abuses are happening in Cuba. These are real and they're serious. The country falls short of international human rights standards on freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of association. But reformers think that what the United States has been doing isn't improving the lives of people in Cuba, and that it's time to try something else. The White House claims that the recent policy changes will promote the kind of progress on human rights that supporters of the embargo themselves are hoping for. Here's Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor, the main architect of Obama's Cuba policy, speaking in a March 2016 interview with The Atlantic.
By opening up travel, by opening up commerce, you're going to empower the Cuban people. they're going to get more resources. They're going to have more interconnectivity to the rest of the world. That, over time, has a greater chance of improving the human rights circumstance in Cuba than this isolation and pressure that we've been applying.
If the past year and a half has been any indication, this has been the case. Since 2014, embassies have been reopened, agreements on direct mail service and environmental conservation have been signed, and there's been greater cooperation on law enforcement. In April, Cuban security officials even toured a U.S. military counter-narcotics center in Key West, Florida. There are also more avenues for credit, banking, and finance in Cuba. Along with other business deals, Starwood Hotels has announced it will be running hotels in Havana, and Nespresso will soon become the first company to sell Cuban coffee in the United States since the revolution. Big-name musical artists like the Rolling Stones and Major Lazer have played in Havana in recent years. U.S. airlines are set to start commercial flights in the fall, while the first U.S. financial institution will soon issue credit and debit cards for use on the island. According to tourism officials in Cuba, compared to the first half of 2015, the number of U.S. visitors to Cuba in the first half of 2016 has almost doubled. Airbnb has exploded in popularity in Cuba's main cities. None of this would have been possible without the administration's new policy.
In March, President Obama visited the island, appearing on a Cuban television show, holding a press conference with Raul Castro, and giving a nationally televised speech in which he openly criticized the government and encouraged Cubans to have their voices heard. This has been happening in a broader context of economic changes, which we covered in our first episode, and somewhat greater political openness, the topic of episode two. Critics of the new policy have called this a bad deal, saying that no changes have taken place in Cuba since the move to restore relations. But former WOLA senior associate Mark Hansen explains how U.S. policy reinforces changes underway in Cuba.
As Cuba has opened up space for the market to exist, for the private sector to exist, for bed and breakfasts to exist, restaurants, independent food sourcing to take place in Cuba, clearly the rising number of American travelers interact with that and feed that in important ways by buying that food, going to those restaurants and staying in those bed and breakfasts and making use of private transportation. So in important ways, the U.S. reforms are actually helping to drive the robustness of the Cuban private sector, which was an important reform that Raul put in place years in advance of the normalization process.
Here's WOLA program director Jeff Thale, who just testified in Congress on this issue, on how the new U.S. policy has helped and why a policy of engagement is more likely to help Cubans.
There isn't any question that engagement has supported kind of the changing and new emerging sectors of the Cuban economy. But beyond that, what I think is really important to say here is that as overt hostility between the government of Cuba and the government of the United States diminishes, as we open diplomatic relations, as trade expands, as it's harder and harder to believe that the U.S. is really about overthrowing the government of Cuba, the space inside Cuba for internal debate and discussion expands. People who want to debate, people who want to raise new ideas, people who want to criticize, no longer can be isolated, scorned, ignored, or tainted as part of the subversive opposition backed by the United States, because that opposition from the United States hasn't completely gone away, but it's very different in character. And so there is a lot more room inside Cuba itself for debate and discussion because U.S.-Cuban hostility has been reduced. And the most obvious example of this is President Obama's visit, right? The president came. He did a press conference with President Castro in which President Castro, for the first time ever, I think, got unscripted questions from the international press and answered them on, public television. President Obama then went and made a speech at the National Auditorium, which was broadcast live all over Cuba, in which on the one side he said warm things about the Cuban people and emphasized that the Cold War was over. And on the other side, he made real criticisms about human rights issues and other things previously, very rarely publicly heard in Cuba itself. So I think what that illustrates is in this new climate, there's just a lot more room for debate and discussion inside Cuba itself. And that's an important and positive contribution to greater political openness and to freedom of speech.
Jeff also believes that at this point, it's less about what the Cubans are or are not doing. For him, this new policy of dialogue presents the chance to bring human rights concerns to the table. But meanwhile, in Congress, hardline Republicans who back the embargo have been losing ground. Bill Leogrand, who co-wrote a recent book on the evolution of U.S.-Cuba relations, Backchannel to Cuba, explains.
I think a lot of people, including Republicans, recognize that the old policy of hostility just wasn't being successful. And, you know, policy in Washington has a kind of inertia. And so policy can stay in place even though it's not working if there isn't a real motive to change it. And I think the president's decision to normalize relations really broke the dam in a certain sense. And so now even lots of Republicans, conservatives, conservative business people all over the country are looking to the possibilities that normalization opens up, the economic possibilities in particular. Dozens of trade delegations have gone down there, some of them even led by Republican governors, all interested in trying to open up the Cuban market and restore the kind of economic relationships that really are natural between Cuba and the United States.
For a long time, the majority of Democrats have opposed the embargo, both in the House and the Senate. But now you can see this momentum for change among Republicans, too. In the Senate, legislation opening up trade and travel passed through a GOP-controlled committee. Just last month, the Appropriations Committee in the Senate voted 22-8 to ease trade restrictions, while three other provisions to ease the embargo on Cuba passed by voice vote, including one that would end the ban on travel. The other amendments allowed for credit to purchase agricultural products, one that ended shipping restrictions, and one that expanded telecommunications to the island.
Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake, whose Freedom to Travel to Cuba Act has 51 co-sponsors, recently told the online publication The Hill that they definitely have more than the 60 votes necessary to pass the bill. The action, though, is really in the House of Representatives, where the most vocal pro-embargo hardliners hold key positions. More and more, House Republicans are not only supporting legislation that would lift the embargo, but are taking the lead on it. Today, four bipartisan bills have been introduced that, taken together, would essentially end all aspects of the embargo in the realms of trade, travel, telecommunications, and agriculture. All four of these bills have been introduced by Republicans and have significant Republican support.
In his time at WOLA, Mark Hansen was very active in educating and organizing House members on this issue. He spent a lot of time on the Hill. He explains here one of the biggest obstacles that he ran into when seeking more Republican support for the movement on Cuba.
The biggest challenge is that President Obama is associated with embargo, the new U.S.-Cuba policy. If a Republican president was doing exactly the same thing as President Obama is doing, I think that you would see, you know, 60 or 100 Republicans move immediately in that direction. You don't see a policy argument. What you hear frequently on the other side of the other side is Obama didn't get enough when he did this deal with Raul. And when you ask, well, what do you mean by didn't get enough? It's very hard for them to express. You know, he should have gotten democracy, or he should have gotten, you know, a new political system in Cuba. It's like, well, in some sense, we get what we want out of this. I mean, we get an opening to be able to sell our goods. We get an opening to be able to invest. We get an opening into being able to do these joint ventures like Starwood is doing with hotels. Americans get their right to travel back. So we get a lot by just ending the embargo, and we don't give up much of anything.
Mark says that having Republicans making some of the very strong conservative arguments against the embargo, like the ones he just mentioned, makes it much more likely that it will be lifted in the next Congress. This past December, 16 members in the House, 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats, formed a bipartisan Cuba working group to advance U.S.-Cuba relations. The Cuba working group now has grown to 22 members, 11 Democrats and 11 Republicans.
One of the founding members of the group, Rick Crawford, a Republican representative from Arkansas, has been leading the charge on easing agricultural trade restrictions. Farmers in his state would have a lot to gain from normalization. Opening up trade to Cuba would create a new market of 11 million people for the United States. Because of the embargo, the U.S. has exported only 180 million in goods to Cuba in 2015. By comparison, exports to El Salvador totaled nearly $3.3 billion.
In March, the U.S. International Trade Commission put out a 450-page overview of how lifting the embargo might impact trade with Cuba. And one of the things this report found was that the U.S. share of Cuba's agricultural market would more than double, from 16 to 34%, while the U.S. share of the market for manufactured goods would jump from 2 to 12%. So constituents from Crawford's home state would reap some clear market benefits from all of these changes, but Congressman Crawford also spoke with Bola a bit more about why he supports normalizing relations.
I see a society there that's on the cusp of some pretty major change, politically, culturally, economically, socially, and we can be a help to that. We can help that along. Just a gentle nudge. I'm not talking about a major presence, but just to show that we recognize it and help nudge that along to a productive end, or we can sit back and continue what we've done for the last 55 years, in which case we see other regimes that don't have those kinds of interests that move in and fill that void. And so what we don't want to see is a nation like Russia, for example, to come in and say, hey, you know what, why don't you just cling to this failed ideology of communism? That doesn't help anybody. It certainly doesn't help us. I think it's in our homeland security strategic interest to have a safe and secure Cuba. And I think the way that you do that is by helping them along the way here economically and allowing us to do some business there and show some, how things have changed to some degree.
Earlier this month, Congressman Crawford led a group of Republicans and Democrats supporting an amendment to permit private credit to facilitate American agricultural exports to Cuba. It would have created conditions for U.S. agricultural imports to Cuba to grow significantly while also decreasing the cost of U.S. food imports for the country. In the end, he ended up pulling his amendment, but in exchange received assurances from House Republican leadership that they would work with him to advance the substance of his bill. This might seem a bit in the congressional weeds, but it's important. It marks the first time that Republican leadership in the House has had to negotiate within their own party members and make even the hint of a concession on Cuba. They were afraid it would pass, so they cut a deal.
Congresswoman Kathy Castor, a Democrat from Florida, is one of the chairs of the Cuba Working Group. She represents a district that includes Tampa, Florida, with a significant Cuban-American population. She's also been taking the lead on U.S.-Cuba policy, working across the aisle with Tom Emmer, a Republican from Minnesota. With Representative Emmer, Castor introduced a bill that would end the trade embargo completely.
You know, I represent a community with a large Cuban-American population, and it has been a real education working for them, listening to them, and they want change. This 50-year-old policy, Cold War policy of isolation, has not served the Cuban people well. It has not served America well. And in fact, that the policy of the embargo and travel ban on Americans is really a violation of Americans' constitutional rights. We can travel anywhere in the world except Cuba. Why is that? Because years ago, hardliners enshrined in the law this very hardcore isolationist policy. I understand the trauma of what happened in the Cuban Revolution in 1959. But it's over 50 years from that now, and we've got to change, and it's going to be through a policy of engagement where we encourage human rights changes and economic changes, because this hands-off approach has not brought an end to their political system. And now we see signs of hope because of engagement and because of what's happening with businesses and human rights groups and churches in America engaging with the Cuban people.
As Congresswoman Castor mentioned, added to this mix is that the politics on Cuba have changed among the American public. Cuba is no longer a dangerous issue. A July 2015 CBS News poll found that 81% of the American people support ending the travel ban, including 71% of people identified as Republicans. And according to the Pew Research Center, conservative Republicans are the fastest growing group of Americans who support opening U.S. trade with Cuba. More than 600,000 American travelers visited Cuba in 2015, and more are interested in doing so every day.
The biggest demographic shift has been in the Cuban-American community. This has historically been the sector of the U.S. population most energetically supporting the embargo. Yet a 2014 Florida International University poll found that 53% of Cuban-Americans and over 60% of Cuban-Americans under 30 want to normalize relations with Cuba. Mark Hansen explains this.
The Cuban-American community is very different now than it used to be. One of the reforms that Raul put in place was to allow Cubans to leave Cuba and return more readily. And so, and then with President Obama making the reform, allowing Cuban-Americans to travel as much as they wanted to and send remittances back, you're seeing a much closer relationship between Cuban-Americans in Florida and the Cubans in Cuba. And so that relationship is robust. We have over 400,000 Cuban Americans traveling back to Cuba every single year. We've got, people estimate, you know, maybe $2 billion in remittances going to Cuba every year. So clearly there's a very close relationship between Cuban Americans and Cubans on the island. And I think what we're starting to see is that the Cuban American community in Miami and in other places where the Cuban American community is robust, they actually want Cuba to thrive. They want their family members who live down there to have a better life. Part of Cubans having a better life is ending the embargo.
These pro-embargo Cuban-American constituencies, particularly in Florida and New Jersey, have underpinned the congressional hardliners' campaign to keep the embargo. But as more and more Cuban voters want better relations, and as major Cuban-American Republicans continue to fund campaigns to end the embargo, it's going to be harder for lawmakers in Congress to ignore them.
And what we're hearing on Capitol Hill is that it's not outrageous to expect the embargo, or at least some aspects of it, to be lifted in the next Congress. But it definitely won't happen magically. It's going to be quite a fight. As evidenced by the recent decision to pull the amendments on travel and trade, the pro-embargo hardliners still hold power over their party, even though it's waning. Still, there's a lot that can happen outside of Congress, and things are moving forward in the U.S.-Cuba relationship.
Officials in the Obama administration, like U.S. Chargé d'Affaires for Cuba Jeff De Laurentiis, Ben Rhodes at the White House, and others, have all said they want these changes to be irreversible. They want more travel, they want more exchange of ideas, and that they want the embargo lifted. Ambassador De Laurentiis and Josefina Vidal, she's the director of the U.S. Division in Cuba's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and she's leading negotiations with the United States, they both said that U.S.-Cuba relations won't be walked back, because doing so is not in either country's interest. But both have also really pushed on the need to build confidence between the two governments after 56 years of hostility. Here's Jeff Thale from WOLA outlining some of the things that President Obama could still do with his time left to improve U.S.-Cuba relations.
A couple of things they can do that would further reduce tension. One would be to suspend or terminate the Cuban medical parole program, which tries to incentivize Cuban doctors to leave their positions in third countries and come to the United States. Cuba sees that as a brain drain and affront to their medical system. We ought to just end that, and we can. The president has the authority to do that. That's one. A second is to rethink the democracy promotion programs that we've had for many years. In a lot of ways, the Cubans describe these programs as efforts to support subversion in Cuba. In many ways, frankly, they're efforts to keep hardline sectors in Miami in business. And they're mandated by law, so you can't just terminate them tomorrow, but there are creative ways you could make them less offensive to Cuba and change the nature of those programs. So those would be positive things in terms of confidence building. There's a number of other things you can continue to build on and expand. So just last week, the United States and Cuba made some advances on counter-narcotics agreement and cooperation. I think next week we'll see some progress on environmental cooperation. We just opened a short-term USDA representative in Cuba. So there's a series of things like that we can do, and I think we'll probably continue to do, that will build practical relationships between the two sides. And then finally, the Cuban Adjustment Act and the wet foot, dry foot policy connected with it let Cubans who reach U.S. soil be paroled in as soon as they arrive, get a work permit right away, get refugee resettlement benefits, and be on the path to citizenship within a year. And that's a set of benefits that are offered to no other immigrants, to no other migrants who arrive at the U.S. border. In fact, if you look at children from Central America, for example, they're detained, processed, and unless they can find their own attorney and make an asylum claim, they're scheduled for deportation.
Within Obama's remaining time in office, we might see some of these changes. It is unlikely, though, that we will see an end to the Cuban Adjustment Act. But even though it's probably not going anywhere for a while, Cubans thinking of leaving are choosing to do so now, just in case. Since relations were restored, migration from Cuba has shot up.
Smugglers have been taking Cubans mainly on an overland route that leads from Ecuador, which at least until recently didn't require any visas for entry, then all the way through Colombia, Central America, and Mexico overland to U.S. border crossings where Cubans present themselves to border officials. In the first 6 months of fiscal year 2016, the number of Cuban migrants arriving overland to the United States increased 84% over the same period a year earlier. If the current rate is steady throughout the rest of this year, almost 80,000 Cubans will end up crossing the U.S.-Mexico border in 2016. That's one out of every 149 Cubans, which is pretty remarkable. This has caused some problems in Central America, where countries like Nicaragua and Panama have essentially closed their borders to any more Cubans trying to cross their territory. Ecuador, too, is now starting to deport some Cubans. Colombia, last year, detained almost 9,000 Cubans in its territory.
To be sure, these are economic migrants. Few, if any, are facing political threats. But as long as U.S. policy stands, and as long as the Cuban economy continues in dire straits, they're going to come. So changes in U.S. policy are underway, and they may be continuing or even accelerating. But we shouldn't expect these new policies to change people's lives overnight. It will take a while for them to take hold.
Cuban analysts whom we talk to also point out that Cuba's government does do a lot of things that are popular on the island. Free education, free health, a right to a job. Life expectancy is long, and literacy levels are high. It's a cultural powerhouse in terms of the arts, and there's a worry that reforms taken by both governments could negatively impact all of that. When we go there, many people mention that the fastest way to get another revolution in Cuba would be to take these things away.
As more and more U.S. tourists come, and as more business deals get signed, there are certainly worries about a return to the pre-revolutionary Cuba, a time when the country was sold as an island paradise escape for wealthy Americans, as organized crime colluded with government leaders and businessmen to cash in on the allure and the vices. Here's Bill Leogrand.
Cubans talk about the tsunami of Americans. This sense that the flood of American tourists and eventually the flood of American dollars will just wash away, Cuban culture and Cuban sovereignty and Cuban independence, and they might fall back into the kind of dependency that they had on the United States before 1959. So that's a real fear, not just of Cuban leaders by any means, but many Cubans have that worry. But at the same time, they recognize that a closer relationship economically with the United States is really essential for their long-term growth. Tourism now has become the most important domestic economic sector. So the United States is the biggest source of tourism going to the Caribbean. So there's no doubt that the number of Americans in Cuba is just going to go up.
The filming of movies like Fast and the Furious and the Chanel fashion show embody this growing dichotomy and foreshadow the change to come. Most recently, the editor of Granma, the state-run newspaper, wrote an editorial asking to know where the money made from these ventures is going. Ordinary Cubans want to know what they are getting, as they deal with food shortages and dilapidated housing, and are blocked by barricades as models strode down the promenade in Old Havana. But as Bill said, the Cuban people know that this is going to happen. The Cuban government knows that this is going to happen. The Obama administration is pushing for this to happen. And the American people want this to happen. And slowly but surely, the U.S. Congress is coming to this conclusion.
Normalizing relations with Cuba will not magically transform the country, but it creates more space for Cubans to push for the new reality they want, and more space for the United States to play a positive role. The more quickly this happens, the better it is for Cubans and the better it is for the United States. So, the end of the embargo on Cuba is now not a question of if, but when. Thank you very much for listening to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today. I hope you enjoyed our three-part series on Cuba. We'll be back again shortly with an interview episode about Haiti. Until then, please keep tuning in and thank you for listening.